Bala Radhi Govinda Bala
Thank you. Hare Krishna. Welcome. This was, what we were just listening to is was Bhagwan Das, who was one of the ecstatic lovers of God who came out of the Neem Karoli Baba tradition. This was recorded in the 70s at a time when, well, I first discovered the Bhakti path. In a certain sense, the Bhakti path began to become a popular way of approaching spirituality in the West, often due to these kirtan singers, Bhagwan Das, later Krishna Das. In this six-week class, we're going to be investigating some of the mysteries of the path of the heart. And our practice is going to be based on two powerful texts from the yogic tradition, the Bhakti Sutras of Narada, the aphorisms on the path of devotion, and the Bhagavad Gita, which, as most of you know, is one of the most important spiritual books in the world. And we'll also be working, practicing, reading, contemplating some of the great Sufi teachings about the way of adoration. Because when it comes to naked devotion, naked divine love, the Sufis really do it better than anybody. And for, you know, just as a an interesting coincidence, today is Eid. It's a powerful Islamic holiday. So we're starting in the realm of the Sufis. And I want to read you a poem of Rumi's, which pretty much gives us the gist of what it is that we're doing. Essentially, what we're about in this class is looking for the love that transcends the physical, even as we find it in the physical. So here are Rumi's words. A woman is God shining through subtle veils. Haughty spirit astride the elegant mare of her body. Loving her, you love spirit, not a corpse. Heart's ease, laughter, meaningfulness, love. Friend, you desire formless things. You are seeking the beloved and don't even know. Well, of course, we know what we are seeking, and many of us have experience of that beloved. So a lot of what we're doing here is unlocking the wisdom of our experience as travelers on the path of the heart. Because every one of us, since birth, has been navigating the forests of the heart. For some of you, it's been a relatively painless journey. For others, certainly for me, a form of rock climbing. And all of us have, in some sense, been mauled, as the great Sufi poet Hafiz says, by the paws of the divine rogue elephant of love. Moreover, no matter how much or how long we've been on this journey, none of us are experts. We're always starting fresh. We're always pushing through to a new level. And yet, love is the field we know most intimately. That's the paradox, because love is the core of us, as spirit itself is the core of us. And love is always trying to open us deeper and deeper into the essence of what love is and what we are. So, as we start, I just want to say to those of you who have not been in these community satsangs or who have not been here for a long time, I just want to remind you of some of the housekeeping details. There'll be an MP3 of this class and of all classes that you'll get tomorrow. There'll also be homework. And, you know, as I often say, there are actually several ways to do this class. One of them, and there's some of you who will do it that way, and that's fine, is you'll listen to the lectures, you'll do the meditation, and let it go at that. But for those of you who want to go into it more deeply, the homework practices actually give us the possibility of really making this conversation a part of your daily life, a part of your whole life. That's a very, very meaningful and beautiful way to do it. Given the fact that many of us are really busy, you may not be able to go fully 100% into all the homework assignments. But I want to suggest that you do as many of them as you can, and also to know that all of these are resources for you that you can keep on returning to. I also want to say that some of the practices that will be in the homework are very wonderful to do with another person. So if you would like a study partner, and I know that many of you normally do this class with a study partner. Some of you actually already know who your study partner is. But if you would like a partner, you can write to Deb and let her know your time zone, and she will fix you up with somebody who's more or less in your time zone or close to your time zone. So let's take a moment now to become present to the shared communal space, the we space, the space of Sangham. In the Path of Love, it's said that there are particular activities that are really important on this journey. And one of them is prayer, another is mantra, another is service. One of the great ones, however, is satsang, being with others who are on the path, telling stories, sharing our experience, and just being present with each other. Right now, we are connected invisibly as companions of the heart, even though we can't see each other. We can feel the presence of one another's essence, our souls. And in order to make this a little bit more concrete, we're going to take ourselves through an act of imagination into the circle of love on the Great Lake of Consciousness. So if you'll close your eyes and find yourself a comfortable posture, we'll begin this journey. So imagine yourself seated on the shores of a vast blue lake. The lake is in the Himalayas. It's a sacred lake. It's called Lake Manasarovar, which means the lake of the enlightened mind. In other words, the light of the lake of pure consciousness. It's so deep that it has no bottom. It's so blue that you can lose yourself in the color. It's translucent. And each of us is seated around the perimeter of the lake. So be aware of the presence of all of us. Feel that in your cupped hands is a small candle, a tea light. And using your fingers, feel that a sacred flame comes out of the tips of your fingers and ignites the flame in the candle. And holding the candle, looking into the flame, feel that you place into the flame your intention for this class and this course. And I'll tell you what my intention is. It is that each one of us experience the alchemical power of sacred love, and that this power illumine us and awaken us and transform us as only love can. Now place your candle in the center of the lake. And again, for a moment, become aware that all of us are represented in these flames. These flames are our commitment, our dedication, our presence. And as you sit with your eyes closed, feeling the presence of all of us, let your attention move down into the heart, feel the presence of your own heart. If you like, you can place your palm over the center of your breastbone and begin to feel the breath flowing in and out through the heart. When I say flowing in and out through the heart, I actually mean literally to sense an opening in the chest wall, so that even though, of course, the breath is flowing through the nostrils, you can actually sense that the breath of the universe is flowing in through the center of the heart. Now, in most of the ancient languages, the word for breath is the same as the word for spirit. So as you receive the breath, see if you can have the feeling that the force that brings the breath in and out of your body is actually the love force of the universe. So even if you're out of sorts, if you've had a very busy day, there's something on your mind, if you're restless or bored, the breath is still flowing in and out of your body, and its flow is the love flow of the universe, the kiss of life, the primal presence of love. And as we open ourselves to receive that love, have the feeling that the universe is making love to you through the breath. The universe, through your breath, flowing into the heart, intends to love you open. Literally, to love you open. To love you open to the presence of spirit, to the presence of love. To love you open to yourself. To love you open to all of us who are here with you. And as you inhale, see if you can receive that intention. And as you exhale, sense the energy of love flowing through your heart, filling your torso, filling the cells of your body. And now we'll chant. Hopefully you have your mantra sheet. If not, you can listen to me and remember next time to bring your mantra sheet. We'll begin with three ohms. And again, this is a great moment to place your hands, your right hand over your heart, your left hand on top of the right, or you can put your hands, place your hands into Anjali Mudra. Let the breath flow in, propelled by the diaphragm. Om. First verse invokes the presence of Guru as consciousness, eternally peaceful, beyond space, stainless, beyond all levels of awareness. The second mantra is an invocation to Krishna, and it says, I adore the Sweet One, the source of supreme bliss, whose grace makes a dumb person eloquent and a cripple cross mountains. And the third verse is an invocation to the Divine Feminine, addressing her as the most auspicious of all auspicious ones, eternally united with Shiva, with God, the Golden One, the Giver of Boons, the Refuge of all beings, adorned with supreme wisdom. Chaitanyam Shashvatam Shantam Vyomatitam Niranjanam Nadabindu Kalatitam Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Mukham Karoti Vachalam Pangum Langayate Giram Yat Kripa Tamaham Vande Paramananda Madhavam. Sarva Mangala Mangalye Shive Sarvatra Sadike Sharanye Triambake Gauri Narayani Namostute. Om. We ask that our practice be of benefit to all beings. We ask that all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. That all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. That we know the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering. We ask that we experience equanimity beyond craving, hatred, and dullness. And we ask to know the oneness of all beings. And once again, be present to the flow of the breath coming in and out of the heart, intending always to open you to the love flow of the universe. In this first class, we're going to basically focus on the essentials, the introductory understandings that we need to walk this path. And we're going to start, of course, with a couple of definitions of love. One comes from the late Buddhist psychotherapist John Wellwood, and the other comes from Jalaluddin Rumi, the great, I think, really the greatest exponent of devotional love. So here is Wellwood. I define love very simply as a potent blend of openness and warmth, which allows us to make real contact, to take delight in, to appreciate, and to be at one with ourselves, others, and life itself. Openness, the heart's pure, unconditional yes, is love's essence. Openness, the heart's pure, unconditional yes, is love's essence. And warmth is love's basic expression, arising as a natural extension of this yes. The desire to reach out and touch, connect with, and nourish what we love. If love's openness is like a clear, cloudless sky, the warmth is like the sunlight streaming through the sky, giving off a whole spectrum of colors, kindness, passion, joy, caring, service, communion, touch, dedication, and devotion. So openness and warmth, or for those of you who are familiar with tantric language, we could say that openness is the Shiva, the pure awareness, the pure spaciousness of consciousness, of reality. Warmth is the Shakti, the dynamic expression that brings all things into existence. So here's Rumi. Love is the way the messengers from the mystery tell us things. Love is the mother. We are her children. She shines inside us, visible, invisible, as we trust or lose trust or feel it start to grow again. So Wellwood's view of love is, I find, deeply human. You know, based on the unconditional truth that love is something that we can feel and that we also can act on. So love is a feeling. Love is also act. It's an action. It's an activity. You know, it's love that makes you look at your sleeping baby and feel your heart warm, you know, well up, but it's also love that gets you to change the baby's diapers and, you know, wash their clothes even when they're being complete brat and you sort of emotionally can't stand them. So this is the quality of nourishment in love. Rumi's statement points to the cosmic and universal truth of love, which is that love is the power of life itself, and that it is also the power that shows us the truth. In other words, again, speaking from a tantric point of view, love is the primordial Shakti, the Shakti that is the heart of the universe and that has become everything, and that creates this universe as a tapestry of intimate relationship. So in other words, what he's saying is that any love you feel actually comes from the mystery. It comes from the source. It connects us to the mystery. Even if our love is, you know, obsessive or just a little spark, nonetheless, it comes as a messenger from the mystery. So though love can be very personal, very specific to another being or a place, it's always connecting you to something greater, because love is the signature of reality itself. And it's also true that we don't always realize that. In fact, a lot of the time we don't realize that, which is why we need the path. And, you know, one other thing about the bhakti path that's really important is that, and we'll say a lot of things about this, the bhakti path, the path of the heart, is a direct path to God. You know, according to every mystical tradition in India and some in other parts of the world, our true nature, our inner self, which is veiled by the mind, by the body, etc., that is veiled in the sense that we can't always see into the heart of ourselves or other people, what the traditions of India say is that our true nature is awareness. And if you study the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali, as many of us have been doing for the last year and a half, you know that our true nature is described as a witness, as the seer, pure consciousness without an object. But here's the thing. Our true nature is not only awareness, and this is the heart of the teaching of bhakti. Our true nature is love. Not only that, God is love. So love in bhakti is both the goal and the means. If you recognize your true nature as awareness, as the seer, that recognition is going to allow you to, let's say, transcend the difficult circumstances of our lives. But if you recognize your true nature as love, that recognition is going to allow you to feel delight, to feel juiciness, to feel adoration, to actually love the circumstances of your life, even when they basically seem impossible. Bhakti is both the goal and the means. It's direct contact with God. If it's any love, if pursued egolessly, will reveal its source to you. Egolessly, of course, being the operative word and the hard part. Bhakti has also been called the easy path. I wouldn't say it's easy, but it's certainly democratic, because it makes use of the natural love that's present in all living beings. And, you know, this is true, as we've been saying, whether you're loving another human being, whether you're loving a flower, whether you're loving your cat, or whether you're loving the truth. The path of love, however, is not facile. In other words, just deciding to love everybody doesn't really mean you'll be able to genuinely feel it. And, you know, yes, it's possible to decide to choose love as a moment-by-moment practice, and I hope you all are and do. And I'm going to ask you to do this as part of your homework, just to decide that whatever happens, you're going to approach it with the awareness of openness, and you're going to direct warmth to it. But so it's a really great practice. But To experience the true depths of love is not under the control of your will. It actually demands grace. It demands help. It demands a transmission of open-heartedness from the source itself. And it's my intention that in this class, you'll all experience that infusion of spirit that we call grace, that which is the alchemical driver of the opening into love that also contains true awareness of spirit. Because the love that we talk about when we talk about bhakti is love that contains within it a recognition of truth. Even though, you know, infatuation, and when I talk about infatuation, my mind goes back to the feelings I used to have when I was 14 of just like, I cannot live without this boy. That kind of infatuation, which is very strong and very beautiful, and which is a flavor of love. But the difference between infatuation and bhakti and true love, which have a lot of things in common, is that bhakti always contains within it the recognition that what you're loving is spirit, that what you're loving is God. When you found that seed, then this love will guide you through its force of attraction and allurement and awaken us. And it's also true that, you know, many of us who follow the path of love, many of us who are even drawn to the path of love, don't always feel either loved or loving. You know, it's much, and I want to say that that really doesn't matter. It's easier to contact spirit when you feel actively loving, but the great thing about this path is that it's enough to want love for love to transform you. You know, I'm sure that a lot of you have had this particular experience of feeling that inner shift that arises, that what you want above everything else in the world is to experience love and to enact love. And you probably have also, you know, found that your avenue to love has traditionally been through a particular human being, a lover or a child or a teacher or a friend. But you may have begun to realize also that in order for love to last, it has to be connected to the great love. So, you know, I have a friend who about 5 years ago fell in love with the baby of another friend of ours. You know, it's fairly easy to fall in love with a baby, as you may notice. But what he said about this experience and what has always resonated so deeply for me with this experience is that as he started to feel love for this child, he realized several things. First, that when he was feeling that love, nothing else, none of the things that were wrong with his life, and there was plenty wrong with his life, none of the things that were wrong with his life mattered because the feeling of this love was so powerful. And not only that, that because of this love, he was willing to do all sorts of things, you know, taking care of the baby, feeding the baby, changing the baby, babysitting, you know, for long hours when the parents had to be at work, because he got so much enjoyment out of being with the child. And at the certain point, he started to realize that even though the child was very cute and still 5 years later is still very cute, that it wasn't the child. It was some kind of connection to divine spirit that he was feeling. So just take a moment and consider someone that you love or that you have loved. Bring that person to mind. And as you consider that person, see if you can actually tune into the feeling in your heart, the felt sense in your heart that comes from allowing yourself to experience real affection and tenderness for another human being. And then remove the idea of the person and just see if you can focus on the feeling. For some of you, that may have been very strong. For some of you, milder. This is a classic meditation technique from the Vijnana Bhairava Tantra, as many of you know. I also want to say that this is a universal experience. I have a friend who used to teach meditation in Houston, and she taught in a church, in a Baptist church, Southern Baptist church, in a community where people are very, very focused on Jesus as the source of love and not very open to any suggestion that love of God can be experienced apart from love of Jesus, love of Christ. They often would argue with her because she was teaching from a kind of Hindu-based tradition. And then one day she gave them this practice. Everyone in her class, there were about 20 people in the class, everyone in the class felt it. And everyone in the class understood as a result that this love, which they had directed towards a human being and which they also directed towards whatever image of Christ they loved, they worshipped, that the feeling was inside them and that it was good in itself, that it doesn't need anything around it to be felt. So there's an alchemy in love. And that alchemy, which kindles soft-heartedness and tenderness, has been pretty much in all of the traditions, East and West, or let's say all of the devotional traditions, East and West, that inner tenderness has been recognized as a primal doorway to the beloved, to your own true nature. So bhakti is one of the paths that Hindu devotional traditions share with the Abrahamic traditions. Christianity is essentially a path of bhakti. And many of the practices in popular Christianity are similar to the practices in Hindu devotional bhakti, in Hindu bhakti, singing, storytelling, prayer. You know, there are branches of Islam, particularly, and Judaism, particularly Sufism and Hasidic practice, where singing the names of God and dancing are core to the practice. So in the Bhagavad Gita, which is one of the texts we'll be practicing with, Krishna describes three basic yogas. One of them is the path of knowledge, which those of you who were in the Yoga Sutra course were practicing. And the point of the path of knowledge is that not only do you study, not only do you use teachings as prompts for recognizing the truth, but you also disentangle yourself from the mind and the body in order to experience your inmost consciousness as your true being. The other path that Krishna talks about is the path of karma, where you perform actions without expecting results, simply for the sake of action. You know, that famous line in the Bhagavad Gita, which I personally have been contemplating and coming to terms with for maybe about 50 years, is you have a right to the action alone, but not to its fruit. So karma yoga is the practice of acting for the sake of action or acting for the sake of God. And the third path that he speaks of is, of course, the path of bhakti, where you let love transform your heart until you see that the world itself is spirit. I would say that these three paths are actually very deeply connected. They all work together. And we'll be saying more about that as we go on. The scholar Edwin Bryant points out something that I find very interesting, which is that the differences between these three paths actually have to do with where you focus your mind. You know, all the Eastern traditions agree that the goal of yoga is to transcend suffering, and that suffering comes through letting the mind get caught in attachment or avoidance, whether it's to your own body, to your money, to things working out well in your life. If the goal of yoga is to transcend suffering, then yoga, even when it's hatha yoga, even when it's postural yoga, is actually practiced through the mind. So every yogic path will tell you, give you a direction, a way to direct the mind. in order to transcend suffering. So in jnana yoga paths like Vedanta and Buddhism, we use wisdom teachings to remind us, well, Buddhism doesn't do this because Buddhism doesn't believe in the self, but in the paths of Vedanta and the other so-called direct paths, we use wisdom teachings to remind ourselves that the stillness of the inner self is the only true reality. In short, we use the mind to stay focused on pure I am without an object, consciousness without an object, on the awareness aspect of the divine. In Patanjali yoga, which is based on meditation, we may use different objects for concentration, but really the goal is to essentially let go of thought so that we can detach awareness from its entanglement in objects so that awareness can rest in itself. In bhakti, however, the method is not to try to still the mind, but to keep the mind focused on God, on Ishwara. Ishwara and Bhagwan are two names in Sanskrit, for sort of generic names for God in Sanskrit. In bhakti, the method is to focus on the personal presence of the divine, whether it's in a particular form, and the bhakti yoga path very much has to do with forms, with Krishna, with Jesus, with goddess, but also on the form of the divine within your own heart. And, you know, again, those of you who know the Yoga Sutra know that the practice called Ishwara Pranidhan, devotional surrender to God, is said to bring immediate samadhi, immediate immersion in the truth. So Ishwara is not described as a specific deity. And this is really important because it tells us that bhakti is not a sectarian path. It's a universal path, whatever particular focal point we might be using. I tend to call that presence, that underlying presence, the source. I tend to call it Shakti, which is, of course, the dynamic face of pure consciousness, the creative ecstasy of pure consciousness. A South Indian sage, Tirumalar, writes, "Those who do not yet understand think that love and God are two. They don't understand that love is God. After truly knowing that love is God, they remain in the love that is God." So there's something very significant about that. If you can remember that the love you feel, even the tiniest spark of affection, is God, is the messenger from the mystery, then it becomes quite easy to stay in touch with that love. Love is the name for the feeling aspect of reality, just as awareness is the intelligent aspect of reality. Love and awareness, or in Sanskrit, chit and ananda, which are names of God. God in Eastern philosophy, in Indian philosophy, is called Chit Ananda or Sat Chit Ananda. So these words, consciousness and bliss, awareness and love, describe the absolute reality. And, of course, what that means is that whenever we love, whenever we feel affection or attraction, we're in a very direct way tapping into the truth of our nature. And you know, there's a lot we can say about the way love expresses itself in the physical universe, for instance, as quantum entanglement, or as what Brian Swim, the cosmologist, talks about as allurement, the primal attraction of particles to one another, which is the basis of form creation in this universe. The word bhakti comes from a root that means to relish or to take delight in, to feel. And, you know, that capacity for delighting in spirit is easier for some temperaments than it is for others. And if you're one of those who doesn't naturally gravitate towards love as a feeling state, just know that we've got you covered. I feel that one of the most interesting aspects of the path of love is the fact that it is the basis of popular religion. And at the same time, it's its practice is the core of mysticism. So we're going to continue with it before we go into the sutras themselves. We're going to tune into a practice that begins to kindle the connection between the love that we long for as human beings and the love that is present that wants to open us up. So again, you can find a posture and you can close your eyes. And ask yourself, what kind of love do I long for? You know, we all have a feeling that there's some form of love that would satisfy us, whether it's, as it is for many of us, you know, love of a lover, of a romantic beloved, or the love of a child, or in some cases, the love of our teacher. What kind of love do you long for? Romantic love? Peaceful love? Now ask yourself, what would I get if I had that love? You know, how would having that love make me feel? You might say happy, you might say safe, you might say protected, you might say ecstatic, you might say satisfied. Now ask, is there any love present here? And just see if you can open your senses. Tune into the air around you and just ask, is there any love present? And now imagine that the crown of your head opens like the shutter of a camera, and the space in front of your heart, in the center of your chest, opens in the same way. And as you inhale and exhale, see if you can feel that this subtle energy of love is present all around you, and is flowing in through your crown and through your heart. And just let yourself receive it. And as you do, you may feel moved to exhale it with the sense that you're offering that love back into the universe. Let yourself receive the presence of love. And you might want to make a note of what your experience was of this practice. It's one that I do often, especially when I'm feeling sort of disappointed and feeling that the people around me aren't, you know, giving me exactly what I would wish they would give me, to just open up and ask, is there any love present? And then let it flow in through your crown and through your heart. So let's now continue to set the stage, some context as we plunge into the sutras. And by the way, that we have translations of the sutras, translations and transliterations up on the website, and the translations that we've put up on the website are by Bill Mahoney, who's a Sanskrit scholar whom some of you know. And of course, they're also in the books that you can buy, which not only have the sutras themselves, but also commentaries. So here is Sutra 1. Atato bhaktim vyakya syamaha. Now, therefore, we shall speak of bhakti, which is translated here as the religion of divine love. So you might remember that the Yoga Sutra starts the same way with the word atta, which means now. You know, and atta sets a marker in the present moment. It basically says, come alive, be attentive, something important is happening, this is the time. So traditionally, I hope that my clapping didn't blow your ears out, traditionally, without entering fully into the moment when the truth is being transmitted, the kindling, the mojo within the truth does not reach you. So you might get it intellectually, but it won't penetrate. So atta is a dharma bell, meaning come to attention. And the second word, therefore, I really love that it says this, because that word, therefore, implies that this is a conversation that has been going on for a long time. You know, it is not the first time that these sages have discussed this topic. And not only that, the word, therefore, implies that there are reasons why each one of us is qualified to be in this conversation at all. You know, that therefore means that we're qualified. We've acknowledged that love is a value to us. Maybe we have some faith that we can succeed in the practice. Or maybe it's just that you're interested. You want to get entangled with God. So the word therefore implies that we're not casual observers, we're practitioners. We are serious seekers. We feel a connection to the spirit, and we want to meet spirit directly in a very personal form. And for many of us, there's also a secret wish to have a direct personal relationship with God. I know for me personally, when I first got onto the spiritual path, the idea of having a direct personal relationship to God was so unfamiliar to me that I couldn't even conceive it. I wasn't even sure that I believed in God, as they say. It wasn't until years later that I realized that the experiences that I was having of spirit were actually experiences of God. It's at that point that you start to be interested in the science of bhakti. Now, Narada, the sage who gave us these sutras, is exactly the right person to explain this, because Narada is famous for having a direct personal relationship with Lord Vishnu, who is the sustaining power of the universe according to Indian cosmography, and who is a good friend of Narada's. So Narada is a recurring figure in Indian mythology. He's an immortal sage who has the power to travel through different worlds and to appear instantaneously when he's called. So there many of the stories in Indian mythology involve Narada showing up at some crucial moment and giving wisdom or offering grace. So he carries a veena, a stringed instrument, and he's constantly chanting the names of Vishnu because devotion is his life. So Narada is the narrator not only of the Bhakti Sutra, but also of another text called the Srimad Bhagavatam, which we're going to be looking at later also. Both of these texts belong to a tradition called Vaishnava Bhakti. Vaishnava means of Vishnu. So it's the tradition of devotion centered on Vishnu. And that said, this is not a sectarian text. The Bhakti Sutras don't demand that you fall in love with the divine in the form of Vishnu. That said, I'm going to focus on that simply because the Vaishnava Bhaktas were the kind of the, they were like the academy of devotion in India. They were, a lot of them were scholars and intellectuals, and they examined the feeling of devotion. They made up rules for it that are interesting to look at. And they, you know, they created an entire doctrine of teachings that actually help us understand not only what bhakti is, but how we can deepen it in ourselves. So one of the things about Vishnu, again, I know most of you know this, is that he periodically takes forms as avatars and appears on earth at crucial moments. As Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, when Dharma is disappearing, I take form on earth. Well, we're at a time when Dharma is disappearing. And I frankly believe that, you know, that the divine is very present here on earth in the form of some of you, that the, you know, that at a time like this, it's especially easy to tune into to divine consciousness through forms as well as through the formless. And Krishna, of course, who's one of the avatars of Vishnu, is the guru of the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna is also one of the main objects towards which bhakti is dedicated, because the heart of this tradition is personal devotion. And in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells Arjuna that it's a lot easier to tune into a concrete individual form of the divine than it is to feel connected to the all-pervasive suchness. And I translate this. It's a lot easier to tune into something or someone that you can actually see with your physical eyes, as it were, or imagine in a form, than it is to tune into awareness itself. That is for most people. And because this is true, because it is basically easier to focus on God in a form, this is why the bhakti teachings are essentially the populist religion, certainly the most popular religious tradition in India. And, you know, and of course, it's also populist tradition all over the world, both in Christian and in Islamic traditions. In the Islamic traditions, in the Sufi tradition, which actually had its one of its great flowerings in India, pretty much up until a partition in 1948, there were Islamic mystics all over India, especially in the north around Delhi, and they tended to love the divine in the form of saints. So they worship at the tombs of great masters of the Sufi tradition. So the bhakti tradition developed in India around the 10th century AD. It's interestingly enough, it's concurrent, more or less concurrent with the development of Tantra as a populist religion. The point was that it's open to anybody who loves God. So there are a couple of stories that I just want to share with you, because the whole teaching of the bhakti tradition is contained in these stories. One of them is about a saint who is an untouchable, and he was in love with the form of Krishna, who was enshrined in a temple at Pandharpur, which is a big city, you know, a big temple culture in Western India. But because he was an untouchable, the priest would not let him into the temple. And one day he had come to worship. He was standing at the front door. He wasn't even trying to go inside, when the priests came out and shooed him, said, "Get away from here, get away from here. Go behind the temple, go get out of here." So he did. He followed the instruction. He went behind the temple. And suddenly, to his astonishment and the astonishment of the priests, the back wall of the temple opened up, and the figure of the deity emerged as a living form of Krishna to give darshan to this untouchable saint. So the tradition of popular bhakti is filled with stories like this, in which somebody who was not part of the upper class or the upper caste proves to be a greater devotee than all the scholars, all the priests, you know, all the high-class people. There is another story which I cannot keep myself from telling you because it's an Islamic story. It's a Muslim, it's a Sufi story. So there's this great saint called Baba Musa, who's traveling by boat down the waterways, you know, in some Middle Eastern country, and he comes to a beach and he beaches the boat for a moment in order to get some food or some water, and he sees that on the banks of the river are two shepherds, and they're praying out loud, and they're saying, "Oh God, I love you so much. If you'll come to my house, I'll make a beautiful bed for you. I'll give you the most delicious food. I'll wash your feet. I have a suit of clothes that I've had made especially for you. Please come to my house." And the sage, the teacher, just decided that he owed it to these two ignorant fools to school them about the nature of the divine. And he went up to them, interrupted their prayers, and said, "Excuse me, sirs, I just want to tell you, God doesn't have a body. So there's no way that God could come to your house. But God certainly doesn't have a mouth. There's no way you could feed them. So I'm going to give you a mantra, and you can worship God by saying this mantra." So, the two shepherds thanked him, and the sage Baba Musa got back in his boat, and he was paddling across back into the main current of the stream when he heard this voice calling his name. And he turned around, and he saw that these two shepherds were running towards him across the water. And he realized that their devotion had given them the power to walk on water. And, of course, he apologized profusely, asked them to school him. So bhakti is democratic, and it was expressed certainly in the Indian traditions, in Hasidism. It's expressed through singing and dancing. So in throughout the middle and late medieval period, bands of villagers would chant and dance at temples and shrines, and they still do it to this day, often walking hundreds of miles while chanting the names of Krishna and Rama. So some of these great bhakti saints would get so intoxicated in love that they would hug everyone they came across, and they would transmit bhakti through their hug. So it's a tradition that is filled with shakti, with divine power. The bhakti poets would often say things like, "Our chanting, our devotion is so nectarian that we'll bring yogis out of their dry samadhi with the nectar of the name." They were the ancestors of the great Kirtanwalas, who are all over India and now all over the West today. So here are the first two sutras, the second and third sutras, which offer the primary definition of bhakti. And as those of you who are familiar with sutra texts know, the first sutras of these texts actually contain in kind of a seed form the gist of the whole teaching. There are over 70 sutras in the bhakti sutras, but it's all here in sutras 2 and 3. So, sa tasmin parama prema rupa, it is of the nature of supreme love directed towards this. I'll say more about that in a moment. Sutra 3, amrita swarupa cha, and it is of the nature of nectar. So, bhakti is of the nature of supreme love directed towards this. What does supreme mean? It means that it's love without conditions. It's unconditional love. And it's very telling that the word they use is asmin, which means this. It doesn't use the word God, Ishwara, Bhagawan, Krishna. It uses the word asmin, which is a completely neutral word. But if you know Indian philosophy, you know that asmin and another synonym for it, which is tat, which means that, are the words which are used to point to the supreme reality, which is beyond name and form, so ultimately cannot be given a name. So bhakti, then, is love simply love directed towards the essence, towards that, towards the thatness of reality. And, you know, in the Bhagavad Gita, as we'll see, Krishna gives many pointers to the nation, to the nature of God. One of them is that God is present within everything, and that whatever form people love, and that includes your mother and your lover and your chocolate bar, he's present in that. So, again, we keep coming back to that. It's a powerful recognition in bhakti. If God is love, then any experience of love is an experience of God. And that means it doesn't have to be consciously directed at the awe-inspiring Father God or the compassionate Mother Goddess, but at the presence, the beingness that can be found everywhere, especially in the human heart. But, and this, again, this is the heart of bhakti. In order for it to bear the kind of fruit that the sutra promises, it has to be directed with the understanding that it's actually aimed at the divine. So if you're looking at your lover or you're looking at your child, what makes it bhakti or what makes it a spiritual practice is that you're doing it with the sense that there is God in that person, in that child. There's a very interesting story about Ramakrishna, who you're going to hear about a lot during this course. For those of you who don't know him, Ramakrishna was a great, great saint of the 19th century who was considered by many to be an avatar of Vishnu and who taught a path of absolute universal love. He practiced many different traditions. He practiced the different forms of bhakti in his own Indian tradition. He also practiced tantra. He practiced Islamic mysticism. He practiced Christianity. And he always said that he found the same God through all these paths. So he was a very important universalist teacher. And he had deep love for his young disciples, especially for one of them, a boy named Naran, who later became Swami Vivekananda, the teacher who did more than anyone to bring the path of Vedanta to the West. And people noticed that Ramakrishna really loved Naran. And someone once said to him, "You know, Master, you really should be more careful because it looks like you're very attached to that boy. And as we all know, attachment is a form of bondage. So, you know, as a great yogi, shouldn't you be more detached from him?" Ramakrishna said, "My attachment is not to him. It's to the God I see in him. If I ever stopped seeing God in him, I would drop him like a hot potato." The heart of bhakti is the realization that whatever you love, you're loving God, and you're loving the beloved. So let's find this recognition. And this is a practice. The practice I'm about to give you is one that, again, I'm going to ask you to do on your own, because it's a practice that becomes more and more juicy the more we do it. It sometimes takes a little while to kind of excavate this experience, but if you keep at it, it's astonishing. So again, place your right palm in the center of your breastbone. Feel the contact between your palm and your chest. Feel that the breath is flowing into the body through the center of the heart. And focus on the place where the caress of the breath touches the energy behind the breastbone and the inside of the heart center. And begin to whisper to yourself, speaking to yourself, "Beloved, beloved, beloved." You might want to say it out loud. if you do, see if you can tune into the resonance in the syllables, beloved. Say it very softly so that it catches that in you which is the beloved. Beloved, 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 beloved. Notice what it feels like to address yourself in this way, to recognize yourself in this way. This is what Rumi says about the beloved in the heart. It was he, not I, knocking at the door. It was he within. I caress my own breast, for there he is hidden. No one else knows you. Since you are I know you. Forms become a trifle when feeling and intuition intensify. In the end, a person tires of everything except heart's desiring, soul's journeying. Sultan, saint, pickpocket. Love has everyone by the ear, dragging us to God by secret ways. I never knew that God, too, desires us. I never knew that God, too, desires us. So as you breathe into your heart, as you caress your heart, as you address the beloved inside your heart, recognize this, that the beloved wants you, needs you, loves you, and is constantly beckoning you from inside your own heart and from inside the hearts of the people in your life. So what happens, of course, is that this unconditional love which is present within us gets mixed up with our needs, our desires, our fears, our ambitions, all the baggage that the human ego naturally brings into the world. Now, I want to tell you, I repeat a story, because many of you know this since I tell it fairly regularly. It's a story about the first time I ever felt divine love. I had taken LSD with my boyfriend. This is in the very early 70s. I was in my 20s. We were sitting in my living room, listening to the Grateful Dead, music, of course, being one of the great prompts for the arising of love, when this vast, overwhelming feeling of love just came sweeping over me, coming out of the air, coming out of the floor, coming out of me. And I turned to my boyfriend and I said, "There's nothing but love." And he said, "Haven't you ever taken acid before?" So I laugh about this. I think it's a funny story. But at the time, the experience was actually heartbreaking, as well as being revelatory, because there was something in that moment which completely convinced me that it was real. Krishna Das has this gospel song. He sings, God is real, because I can feel him in my soul. I didn't call it God. I called it love. But the heartbreak was because I saw that the guy I was with was not going to be able to meet me there. He didn't get it. And of course he didn't get it. He was having a different experience. But because of who I was at the time, you know, because I believed that love was something that you had to get from another person and that had to come in a particular way, otherwise you couldn't experience it as love, the feeling of hurt that arose just wiped the love out. And in other words, what had arisen as pure divine love, as simply presence, took on the coloration of my particular samskaric patterning that, you know, the coloring of my past impressions, which tended to skew towards the drama of heartbreak and disappointment. And this is what often happens to our experience of love when consciousness is unpurified, because whatever early childhood or past life impressions we might be carrying, whether negative or positive, are going to distort or skew our experience of the great love. You know, and they might make us feel that love is out of reach, that we need this particular person in order to feel love. So this is why just asking yourself, is there any love present, which I invite you to do now, and to open your heart like the shutter of an old-fashioned camera, and to open your crown and invite it to flow in with your breath. This is from Kabir. The bhakti path winds in a delicate way. On this path, there is no asking and no not asking. The ego simply disappears the moment you touch him. The joy of looking for him is so intense that you just dive in and coast around like a fish in the water. So we could say that love manifests in two basic aspects. One is personal, the love that arises within us and is directed towards someone or something. The second is universal, meaning the love, the shakti, that's the basis of reality, that's actually what we are inviting when we do this practice of asking if there's love present. And both these forms of love have a quality of presence. It, you know, it, presence being the word that we currently use to express the felt sense of this ineffable suchness that we more and more come to recognize is the heart of what we love in life. It's presence. It's this actual feeling space, this felt experience, this energetic quality that we can touch with our inner senses. And, you know, presence is a palpable feeling that's often centered in the heart, but which we also can feel in others. And, you know, you can feel it in a tree or in the eyes of a deer and the tenderness you feel when your cat's asleep in your lap. And here's the thing. Love's presence is food. It's what the soul lives on. It's what allows the soul to grow. Soul growth, and that's, according to all the greatest sages, why we're here. We're here for soul growth. And when I say soul growth, I mean the growth of our personal capacity for connectedness, for wisdom, for affection, for intuitive awareness of the truth. The soul is nurtured and grows through the experience of love. So consider, again, what it feels like when you're with someone who loves you. So this is about receiving. Whether it's a lover, whether it's your partner, whether it's a family member or a friend. And there may be particular moments in your life when you felt that presence, when you felt loved. Or it may be a general feeling. But notice how it feels in your body. When you feel loved. See if you can recognize that warmth or openness or fullness or softness that arises from the feeling of being affectionately seen by another human being. Unless you're feeling particularly insecure, and there are certainly times for all of us when we feel insecure, one of the things that makes us realize that feeling loved is real is that this energetic feeling, this energetic quality, actually has the quality of truth. It's like when you feel loved, and I'm going to ask you to contemplate this a bit over the week to come. When you feel loved, there is this recognition that what you are feeling is the actual truth about life. You know, some of us had better parenting than others. Some of us have had more loving experiences than others. But I don't believe there's anybody who doesn't recognize when you receive love that comes to you unconditionally, even if it's only for a moment, you recognize that this is the truth. So love, whether you give it or receive it, refines the soul. Love refines the soul. Love refines the heart. You know, our hearts are very covered with various, let's call them impurities, various blocks, various glitches. And really the process of spiritual life is refining the heart, which means refining the soul, because in most of the traditions, the soul is seen to live in the heart. And this refinement is what eventually makes the soul clear enough to perceive and even merge with its true nature, with its source. Devotional love, bhakti, is always connected to truth. It comes out of the innate recognition of the pull of the heart towards truth. And the truth that the heart knows is seen through the heart. It's seen with the eye of the heart. It's not necessarily, sometimes it coincides with it, but it's not necessarily the truth you see with your eyes open. You know, it's not the truth that counts the petals on a flower. It's not the truth that we see with the intellect where we're able to discern when somebody's lying. It's the truth we see with the eye of the heart, which is actually able to look through the physical reality and to look through the glitches in another person and to see the innocence, the freshness, the sweetness, the presence that is their essence. So, and when you see with the heart, again, even for a moment, you're seeing the divine in another person. So if you, you know, for instance, if you ever fell in love with someone utterly inappropriate, I don't know about you, I've done it a few times, you know, maybe you hated their politics or they were married to somebody else or they were the wrong age or they just didn't love you back, you know, or maybe they were your student or your boss. But at a certain point, you realize that this relationship in the real world is not going to work and you ask yourself, what was I thinking? But if you really look at the karmic beyond the karmic circumstances and see with the eye of the heart, you realize that when you looked into that person's eyes, when you felt this love connection, that what you were seeing was a spark of divinity in them. It was the divinity that's in all of us, that allures us, which doesn't mean that some people aren't more alluring to us than others. But even if, you know, even if the love we feel is inappropriate, when you're in that space of connecting to the divine in that other person, it's true. It's just true. And it's going to refine your soul. As long as you can keep yourself focused on that unconditional state of love. Let's again take another breath in and out of the heart. And I want to refine the practice that we just did of noticing when we're loved. Your eyes are closed. And I'm going to ask you to tune in to the love of God in two particular ways. Imagine that love is flowing towards you from the divine presence that is the source of the world. And you don't have to give this presence a name or a form. Just understand that this presence is everywhere and all around you. And imagine that this presence is loving you in an absolutely unique and personal way. So we're talking here about the God of Bhakti. That is to say, the God who knows your name. The God who is, yes, inside you, but who is also in relationship to you, is a divine other whom you can experience in relationship. And imagine for a moment that this divine other is sending towards you the love of the greatest, the most loving mother that ever existed in this world. Loving you like a mother. But not a mother with her own issues. A mother whose love is utterly unconditional and utterly personal. And just allow yourself to feel that. Yourself feel mothered by the divine reality. And just notice the feeling. And now imagine that this divine lover, this divine mother, is loving you as a lover, is loving you romantically, even sexually, is directing very personal romantic love at you, is in love with you in the way that you've always wanted someone to be in romantically in love with you. And once again, because it's that who's loving you, because it's God who's loving you, there is no neediness, there's no conditions. It's just pure romantic devotion coming towards you. Let yourself receive it. You might notice that there's a little difference in the felt sense of the motherly love and the romantic love. Maybe not. Please take a moment and just jot down a couple of notes if you like. I believe that it's more or less impossible to love others without having some experience of being loved yourself. So for me, always the most crucial part of bhakti practice has always been letting myself receive, which is not all that easy for me. I like many of us, I'm more comfortable offering than receiving. But it's in the receiving that the heart really opens and that your capacity for being refined by love becomes most palpable. You know, as we'll be seeing in the weeks to come, one of the great things about the bhakti traditions is that it has space for every form of relationship. And there are sutras which will explain it, so I'm not going to go into it now. But the idea here is that all of your relationships can be turned towards God. They can be experienced as flavors of your love for God, and they also can open you to your love for God. The word bhakti, as I've said earlier, comes from the root bha, which is connected to another Sanskrit word, bhava, which means feeling or attitude. And in bhakti, there are many different feelings or attitudes that will nurture you on the path. And again, this is one of the distinctive aspects of bhakti as a path, because it makes use of all your emotions, as long as you can direct them towards God. You know, most of the classical spiritual paths, the non-bhakti spiritual paths, will tell you to let go of emotions, even to disdain emotions, you know, to practice detachment. That's one of the main points of yoga, as it's explained in the Patanjali system. in Bhakti, you cultivate emotions. So, and there's, that's an extraordinary piece of generosity of this path, if you think about it, because in Bhakti, even feelings that are considered negative, for example, like hatred, if they're directed towards God, can become liberating. There are a lot of stories in the Bhakti literature about people who hated Krishna. He had a lot of enemies during his lifetime, his life on this earth, and even some whom he killed. But in the end, they all became one with him. They all merged with him. Because even hatred or jealousy directed towards God is liberating. And, of course, this is even more deeply true when the emotion is affectionate. So I wanted, you know, I was very struck years ago. I read a book by a religious scholar named Jeffrey Kripal, who, when he was a young man in the 60s, spent some time as a postulate, maybe actually it was later than the 60s. He's a bit younger than me. He spent some time as a novitiate in a Jesuit order. And he went to his spiritual director at one point, as, of course, many of the young monks did, because a bunch of young men. And he confessed to him that he was feeling lust. So here's what his spiritual director told him. He said, go to the chapel and embrace the statue of Jesus in the chapel. Let your feelings of lust be directed towards Jesus. This is, I think, really quite extraordinary. Because, of course, the Catholic Church is notoriously homophobic, but they understood that when you direct sexual feelings towards the divine, that your feelings become a pathway to increasing your devotion. I think it was very intelligent of them to direct them towards the statue of Jesus rather than towards, you know, another person, which is another story about Catholic priests. But there's an incredible insight here that, you know, and of course, nuns were described as brides of Christ, the great Christian mystics, like Teresa of Avila, related to Jesus as a lover. That in the story, in the legends of Krishna and Rama, romantic love was, you know, especially in the stories of Krishna, romantic and sexual love were described as pathways, not as something you had to get rid of, but simply as something to direct towards God. So we'll see as we go on, and you'll see in yourself that each of us has particular emotional connections to the divine, particular pathways that are attractive to us, that take us closer towards God. Anytime, as I've been saying, you feel the presence of love, of warmth, of openness, you're experiencing the presence of God. Guru Mai, one of my teachers, was once holding satsang for a group, and one of the women in the group asked her, what is God? Tell me, what is God? And Guru Mai said, have you ever been in love? And the woman said, yes. Guru Mai said, God is the purest form of that love. So that's a good description. But it isn't only being in love, and that's the magic, that's the alchemy of this path. It's any strong emotion directed towards God. If I would say if there's a mistake that you can make in the Bhakti path, it's indifference. But, of course, we don't always feel strong emotions. We're not always in love or in hate or anything like that. And what Rumi says is that it doesn't matter. You can turn anything over to God. There's one of my favorite Rumi poems about this. Goes like this. If you cannot pray sincerely, offer your dry, hypocritical, agnostic prayer. For God in his mercy accepts bad coin. If you have 100 doubts of God, make them into 90 doubts. That's the way. If you haven't any knowledge but only opinions, have good opinions about God. If you can only crawl, crawl to him. And here's the verse that always makes me cry. O seeker, though you have broken your vows 100 times, come again. O seeker, though you have broken your vows 100 times, come again. Come again. Come again. So there are two types of bhakti. We'll be looking at them both. The first type, which is called in Sanskrit Gauna Bhakti, is the path, the practices, the mental attitudes. The second type of bhakti, which is the fruit, is called Para Bhakti, or supreme devotion, also known as prema, which means love. So there is actually a distinction in this path between bhakti, which is what you do in order to experience divine love, and prema, which is the actual experience of divine love. So you can be practicing bhakti without actually being in the state, but by practicing bhakti, you will eventually, and I can tell you this from experience, this is one of the things I can vouch for, if you keep practicing bhakti, you're going to start experiencing love, not just from time to time, but pretty much as your default experience. So, but you get to it in stages. So here are the stages, or at least here's a take on the stages. And again, this is from one of the great Indian bhakti writers. The first stage is realizing that God exists. And this is no small thing, you know, as we know in this world. Let's say the opinion of most people in the secular world is, you know, fairly doubtful that God exists. A lot of very smart people have issues about the existence of a supreme deity. But one of the first fruits of practicing bhakti is that you begin to feel presence and you begin to identify it as sacred. For a lot of us, that presence arises first through music, which is why kirtan chanting is so not just important, it's also why it's become so popular in the yoga world. It's not just because there's some great musicians who chant kirtan, it's because chanting the names of God opens the heart, and it's pretty much, I won't say automatic, but it's pretty palpable. You know, and so chanting is a pointer to the divine. Standing in a forest, watching the moon rising over the water, embracing your beloved or your child, all of these are pointers to God, and you might feel divine presence as the feeling of sweetness. That's one of the pointers. That's one of the forms that we experience God in, as joy, as tears. You know, there's other descriptions of what happens when God's presence becomes known to you, one of which is that, and this happens to some people, the hairs on your body stand on end. It's called horripilation. For me, it's always tears. And I've come to feel that when tears start to arise, it's not just a pointer, it's not just a way of recognizing God's presence. It's actually a pointer towards the path in this moment. And that's one of the real secrets of the bhakti path, that when love arises, when sweetness arises, when tears arise, when the heart starts to melt, you can take it as a sign that you're on the right track. So the first stage of the bhakti path is realizing that God exists and actually eventually being able to feel God's presence. Eventually, you get to the point where you actually feel the presence of God as a being, as we were saying earlier, who knows you, the God who knows your name. It's a Hasidic understanding. It comes from the Jewish tradition that when we pray, when we study, when we turn towards the heart, at a certain point, we begin to realize that there is a God and that God knows us. God loves us personally, that God desires us, as Rumi says. So that's the second stage. You recognize your personal connection. In the third stage, you start to get a sense of what Godness really is. In other words, you start to connect the feelings that you have with what the sages say about the divine, which is one reason why study is helpful in this path. You know, you see why God is described as Sat Chit Ananda, because you begin to get a distinct sense not only of the presence of this divine, of spirit, but also of its juicy, bliss-saturated nature, and of its intelligence, of its knowingness, of the fact that when presence, that presence is present, it fills you with insight, it fills you with understanding. And I know, you know, because there are a lot of you here on this call who've had a lot of experience in different spiritual traditions and have had the experience of how insight starts to arise in you when you become immersed in that feeling of presence. There are things that we're able to know through our connection to that, that we basically don't know through our minds. I'm going to tell you a story. I have a friend who's Latino. He grew up in South America and in a Catholic family, and lost his faith at a certain point and then came to meet my guru and had a really big awakening experience, which took the form of love. And shortly after that, he went home to visit his mother and went to Mass with his mother, mainly, you know, just for the sake of keeping his mother company. And when the moment came, as it does in Mass, of when the, you know, the priest holds up the communion wafer, holds up the wine and the bread, and recites the words over the offering, which invite the divine energy to come into the substance. It's called transubstantiation. And at the moment that he did that, my friend saw a light coming down from the ceiling of the cathedral and entering into the wafer and the wine. And he realized that communion is real. It's true. It's that when they tell you that the wafer and the wine are the body and blood of Christ, there's something in that lineage which is kindled that enters it. And, you know, I would say in understanding that story, which I've always found very beautiful and mysterious, is that every great tradition has a lineage, and that it's the lineage which creates the miracles, of which love, of course, is the greatest one. So in this third stage, you get a sense of Godness as all-pervasive, as being awareness and joy. And as that feeling grows, and this is the beauty part of it, you start to experience that the feeling is good in itself, and that actually it's the source of your happiness. And this is when you become a God-intoxicated bhakta. You know, I want to tell you that if you let yourself open to this text, and I gave you the Swami Prabhavananda version, Narada's Way of Divine Love, as the text that we'll work with, because that text is saturated with the love of the Ramakrishna lineage. It's a very, very juicy version of the Bhakti Sutras. And I think if you read it, and, you know, hopefully through these lectures and your work, you'll catch Bhakti from its pages. I can't claim to be a perfect exemplar of the Bhakti path, but I will tell you, and I know many of you had the same experience, that when divine love catches hold, it carries a happiness and a feeling of satisfaction that makes me feel that it's all I need. It doesn't matter whether I'm sick or well, or, you know, getting along with my friends, or under a lot of pressure from some obligation or other, that when that feeling is there, everything is joyful, even heartbreak. So during these 6 weeks, I'm asking you to make the state of your heart the main driver of your practice. Keep your awareness in the heart. Whenever you remember, bring your awareness back to the heart and begin to observe what makes it expand and contract. And you can practice with the caress of the breath. You can practice with your mantra. I'll be actually giving you a mantra next week. You can practice with chanting tapes, chanting CDs. I've actually made a playlist, which is on Spotify. It's called Sally's Bhakti Playlist, and I will send you the link to it. It's got songs from some famous kirtan singers, Krishna Das and Wah and Bhagwan Das, that are very juicy and tend to make love arise in the heart. As many of you know, chanting is one of the greatest of all bhakti-friendly practices. Singing itself is great. Listening is great. Music is great. So notice the thoughts and feelings that let the heart relax and open. When you interact with other people, see if you can take the time to look into their eyes and find that spark of divinity. And also, this is going to be in the homework, go and stand or sit in front of a mirror, look into your own eyes, and notice that spark in yours. Let yourself fall in love with yourself. Let yourself recognize God in you through the eyes. It's also important to let your heart be as it is. In other words, very often when we tune into the heart and the heart is not feeling that open or is feeling kind of hard, we tend to freak out and think we've done something wrong and it's a problem and we have to fix it. One of the things that happens on this path is that a lot of our stuff, our schmutz, comes up. So there are going to be times when your heart feels very open and times when it feels like a dried up raisin. And at these moments, just let yourself be present with the heart. Ask yourself, is there any love here? Is there any love present? And see if you can let yourself breathe in with the feeling that love is coming towards you, that love doesn't care whether your heart is open or closed. Love wants to open you, and you can just let yourself relax in that intention. That's the alchemy. That's the alchemy of bhakti. And I want to offer you this thought that, because I know that, you know, as I look at the list of people here, I see that many of you are bhaktas, many of you are devotees, and many of you know this, that bhakti is the driver and the motivator of your entire spiritual path, that the more you realize that you're doing this for the sake of love, whether it's meditating, chanting, reading, really all your practices, you're actually performing an experiment and opening to gaining deeper and deeper access to devotional love. And as you learn what enhances love in the heart, you discover more and more deeply what constitutes your personal path. In the bhakti path, you learn to follow the swells of the heart, to take the hints that come, following like the breadcrumb trail through your life. What increases your love? Move in that direction. When do you feel love contracting? Notice the thoughts and attitudes that you're having. And move back towards openness, towards warmth. Just by turning to the heart, you begin to access the alchemy of bhakti. Rumi says, if you cannot pray sincerely, offer your dry, hypocritical, agnostic prayer, for God in his mercy accepts bad coin. If you have 100 doubts of God, makes him into 90 doubts. That is the way. O seeker, though you have broken your vows 100 times, come again, come again. Have a wonderful evening or day. If you have questions, please write them down and feel free to send them on the listserv. We're going to be having a couple of question and answer sessions in the course of this time together, but some questions need to be answered immediately. And don't hesitate to share. Thank you so much for being here. So much love.
Bala Radhi Govinda Bala Oh, no.